Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a podcast about the weekly Torah portion, the Parshat HaShavua. This is Aaron Roller, and I'm here with Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, Rabbi Bienenfeld, how's it going?
It's going great. Had a great week. Very excited to be basically starting the Torah all over again, although we're sort of a week off that trajectory here. But it's all good, and yes. Excited to be speaking here with you.
Yes, this is our first podcast after a recording mishap last week, but We're diving in a very appropriate metaphor for this week's parsha.
Yeah, I thought there's something actually very poetic about all of this because we say that the reason why the first word of the Torah is Bereshis, which starts with a bet, is because aside from the fact that Torah has no end, it also has really no beginning. That's the reality of infinity, that it has no beginning point, no end point. So maybe there's something poetic about sort of jumping in on the second week here, as if to say that there's this whole murky pre-existence to this podcast. That's, and we'll get there next year, God willing.
Just as the Torah begins with the second letter, we are beginning with the second Torah portion.
Something like that.
So did you... Anything going on in your life? Anything exciting?
Lots of exciting things. The Yomim Tovim are over. Very, very busy holiday cycle. And happy to be getting back to real life a little bit.
Is your voice back?
Barely.
That's one upside of us having... lost the first recording, as you were quite hoarse. Did you see this? I'm guessing your wife did not tag you in the YouTube clip of Adam Sandler and Howard Stern reciting the blessing on the Torah.
Not only did I not see it, was I not tagged? I didn't know that anybody was tagged, and I didn't know it existed.
So, all right. So, Adam Sandler is on Howard Stern's radio show, and they start talking about bar mitzvahs, and there was something kind of amazing and then also something kind of depressing about it. So Howard Stern says to him, if I just said to you, Baruch es Hashem Hamvorach, and Adam Sandler just responds, Baruch Hashem Hamvorach, like he just responds,
wow.
And they both then sing the next bracha with the right tune and everything. But then Howard Stern goes, and you don't know what the F it means. You never know. They don't even tell you what it means. And it's like these two guys, multimillionaires, they have time to study or learn anything they want, and they are just still in total ignorance or bewilderment at the Torah and what they were actually doing at their bar mitzvahs. So
that is amazing. So with that in mind, can I say the following to you?
Yes.
Baruch Hu Et Hashem Hamvorach.
I'm not so clear on how the tune goes. No, but hopefully, listen. Maybe we'll get.
That is really wild.
Maybe we'll get Adam Sandler and Howard Stern on listeners to the to this show. And,
one never knows.
All right, so let's get into Noah, our second parsha in the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishit, and we're gonna try to translate everything from that we say in Hebrew into English. I don't know if we'll translate everything from English to Hebrew. that'll be for the Israeli edition, but. So Noah, or Noah as he's known in English, who is Noah?
Noah is a man. He's a person. He is 10 generations deep as far as the Torah's enumeration of the different generations go. And he lives in this really confusing time. It's hard to know how things spiraled out of control so swiftly. Commentators say some different things about just exactly how this all happened. But apparently, we've had this terrible, terrible fall from grace from Adam and Eve living in the Garden of Eden to Noah, who's just completely surrounded and entrenched in this most despicable of societies.
So there's a kind of like a mixed feeling about him in the way the Torah... He doesn't talk a lot. Like, we never get him. God speaks to him, but he doesn't speak back to God, I don't think, right?
I don't believe so. He doesn't talk all that much. I'm trying to remember when it is that he speaks first.
I don't think he speaks till he like curses and blesses his kids.
I think that may be it. It could be. I think that may be the case. I think we may have discussed this last year a little bit in shul, but that may be just right. That the first words that we actually hear out of his mouth may actually be the curse that he shoots towards his son.
So I guess with that in mind, the commentary is kind of. Are left to infer whatever they can about his personality, and they come up with sort of like a there's kind of a differing opinions about about who, you know, how great he really is. He's obviously, you know, spoiler alert, he is the only person in his generation who merits to be saved from the flood.
Along with his family.
Along with his family. So are the family righteous also, or is it just that it would be sad for him to lose them?
Yeah. I mean, in the classical approach that the commentaries take, it sounds more like they almost perhaps get in under the wire before they're old enough to really be held accountable for their own wrongdoing.
What about his wife? She's got to be
about, what about his wife?
Behind every great man, right, is a great woman. Is that...
there are some different comments made about his wife. So I don't know. I'd want to leave that one.
All right.
But yes, let's at least assume that that's the case. That behind every great man certainly stands a great woman, and you know, they're unified and they're one. And let's maybe leave it at that.
So why? What's the stream of thinking that says that he is not a not all that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and I think what you're referring to, this is one of the, you know, the primary commentator on the Torah, which is Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, medieval French commentator, and really the first to author what we consider to be a more contemporary style commentary on the Chumash. Quotes the two different schools of thought on Noah. Noah is referred to as being tamim, as being, I suppose, perfect or complete, but only bedaratav, only in his own generation, and that is open to interpretation. Then, what exactly is that comment supposed to mean? Does it mean that he is perfect in his own generation, meaning to say that even in a generation of such rabble rousers, he was still able to sort of hold it together and maintain a basic working ethical lifestyle? Just imagine if he had somebody like Avraham to pal around with, how much greater he could have been. On the one hand, and on the other hand, it also spins in the exact opposite direction. That, yeah, he was great. He was great in his own generation. Relative to everyone else, but not necessarily if he was in another generation. I don't know that those two comments are really arguing with one another in terms of the facts on the ground. I mean, he was who he was. He was not as great as Abraham. He was not as great as some of the personalities that we read about later on in the Chumash. That is without a doubt. Having said that, the question is, what comment and what perspective is the Torah really taking or sharing with us? Is it that we're trying to let you know that? Or are we speaking about how great and wonderful and admirable it is to be amongst a group of less than stellar friends and neighbors, and nevertheless be able to shine to whatever degree?
Well, I think that plays into like two questions that I had reading the Parsha. Number one is, what is this episode even doing here, right? If you know, and we don't know, you know, I guess one of the things maybe we'll be exploring is, what is the theme, what is the ostensible purpose of the narrative in Sefer Bereishit? But for like, what is the story of Noah? If let's say we're trying, let's say that the Torah is trying to get us to Abraham and the formation of the Jewish people and his selection by God as the patriarch to many nations. This seems like it's kind of like stuck in there. You know, there are thousands of years from the Garden of Eden, the creation of the world, Adam and Eve, till Abraham. And this flood is just one very bad year amongst those years. The Torah could theoretically have told us about any number of people living any number one of those years. This is a momentous story, no doubt. It's inspired, certainly a recent movie. I don't know if there's, you know, and there's the, of course, the song, you know, the, what's it called? Rise and shine and give God, you know, that's,
of course, yes.
That's, you know, important. So an important cultural,
forgive me. I don't really, haven't listened to, the pop music stations in a number of years.
You know, he built it out of hickory barky, but,
correct.
Right. But it's, you know, so I'm saying it's a good story. It's valuable, but it's sort of like, number one, like, what's it doing here, really? And number two, sort of, it seems to me that, like, it's maybe less a story about this righteous man and more a story about how God almost, comes to regret having created the world.
I think that's a lot of it. And I think both are true. Or maybe, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, let's assume for a moment, right, that the two different schools of thought, right, quoted by Rashi, mm-hmm. Let's presume for a second that really everybody agrees. Facts on the ground, Noah is who he was. The question is, what perspective is the Torah taking? Is the Torah attempting to tell us that Noah was really righteous for his own generation? How admirable, even though he lived amongst all these all these rabble rousers and the like.
Why do you call them rabble rousers? Like, they're like, is there a specific reason that relates to a Hebrew word? Because it just...
no, man, yeah, riffraff. And, I don't know, man.
Bad people.
Really, really, really bad people.
Okay.
Really bad people. You know, on the one hand, then yet on the other hand, you compare him to Avraham, so he's not much to write home about, perhaps. So, like, why would the Torah be taking that perspective? Isn't that odd that the Torah would be throwing in a comment about a person only in order to let you know that just slow down. He's not as great as you really think he is. Lest you start comparing to some of the greatest people who ever lived. And it's just not the case. Why would that be relevant? Maybe it's relevant for just that purpose, that as God is about to destroy the entire planet, right? Sometimes it becomes very difficult for any one of us to think or consider that God actually cares, especially about my individual life and my individual role in the great sweeping context of all that there is to run and control and be aware of. Throughout the entire universe and all the cosmos, could God really care about little old me? And maybe here you have an example of somebody who might not even be the greatest, most righteous person who ever lived or really even belong in that conversation, and yet fair is fair. He was decent, he was good, he was moral, he was just. Maybe if only average when compared to people like Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and nevertheless, he's saved. I think that says a great deal about the relationship that every single person ought to believe that they can have with God.
That we, I guess simultaneously, that A, we could be saved, so to speak, that we could be worthy in our own small lives, and I think maybe also that we could maybe save the world, that we could, that there's a, you know, however modest our abilities may be, that we have the potential to do something great,
really great, something really cosmic, something huge.
I think that's a good message. So moving on to the Ark, one thing I don't want to talk about because it drives me like it, you know, thinking too hard about it, you know, like it'll just cross my eyes and you know, blow my brain is the, you know, question of how do you interpret this in very real terms, in terms of the world we know. Like, were there marsupials on it? Like, we have animals that are only in Madagascar and only in Australia. Did they journey to the ancient Near East to get on this ark? I don't want to get into like the science of it, because I think, you know, firstly, we're probably not qualified, and also it's just like it's just a rabbit hole that I don't want to get into. But you know, so he builds an ark, and I mean, is there anything to say about like what the ark is like, or what he's doing on the ark, or I mean, it's something. I was talking to somebody about it, and they made reference to the seed bank that's, I think, up in Sweden, like the idea of like this repository of life, trying to save everything. But is there a deeper significance to it in rabbinic literature or in the interpretations?
It was really hard. It was really, really tough to be on that boat. I mean, there's the famous comment Rashi brings, actually, regarding Noah coughing up blood and perhaps being attacked by the lion, having been, you know, late to feed him. I think what all of those stories, anecdotes point to is that this was a very, very difficult task, and by no means then when you have this even wonderful relationship with God, and when you are flattered by God actually caring and actually reaching down and shining the spotlight on you and saying you're worthy, and I wanna grab you by the hand, by no means is it going to be easy. It was a rough ordeal, and I think you can look at that in the same way that you did before, which is that, you know, Noah has this opportunity to really save the world. He saves not only humanity, but he saves the entire animal kingdom. And it's a very difficult process. It's a very, very rough ordeal. And things that are worth doing generally don't end up being especially or particularly easy.
I think that's really interesting, because you also, reading this, the thought occurred to me, like, if God wanted to, God could just make everybody else disappear. Like, there doesn't have to be a flood, and there doesn't have to be an effort made to build an ark. Like, none of it, like, if you're venturing into the realms of the supernatural, and there are miracles here that are straight written down in the Torah, and then there's, like, you know, just the technical detail of, like, how did he close the ark door so that, you know, the Medrash comes in and says God closed the door.
Yeah. To them.
You know, in case you were wondering. So there's a lot of miraculous stuff happening here. So, but even with the miraculous, divine, supernatural element thrown in there, it's interesting. Like what you said, like it's not a, there's got to be work involved.
No cakewalk. No cakewalk building and then filling up an ark with animals.
And I think,
the time element is something that I'm always overwhelmed by. And as much as you wanted to stay away from the questions of how exactly, what was the process, how did all the animals get there? I mean, what I am always just frightened by whenever I hit those psukim is trying to figure out the number of days and what month it was and how long. And the Torah really belabors that point, doesn't it? That it was just a long and dark and rocky process sitting on that. I mean, consider seasickness, consider just how dark and damp it must have been, what exactly the sources of light were, if they were plentiful at all, animals screaming, what the smells must have been like. I mean, this was a really, really difficult ordeal that lasted, about a year.
It is very evocative. I mean, it's interesting just talking about this, like how there's a lot of animals in the Torah, which is, I mean, not surprising because, you know, one thing that I think we forget about, like, as people living in a contemporary age, is how many more animals there were, like before we killed them all and put them on nature reserves. But like, you know, they were part of your life. But it's interesting, like some of the most, I'd say, like especially when teaching children, some of the most memorable parts of the Torah are involve animals. We've got Jonah and the whale. We've got Bilam and his donkey. There's
serpent,
camels, right. Play
serpents in the Garden of Eden.
The zoology of it, you know, the presence of all these animals are really, it's interesting. But what do you think about the, you know, so they're on the ark for how long? It's like, it's a year on the ark?
About a year, yeah.
It pours for 40 days, and then there's 40 days when there's no dry land.
Just
and
everything just stops, and I mean, it goes on days and days and days until the point that finally the ark comes to rest, and really comes to rest on the tops of the mountains, and then the water continues to recede, and it's just it's just as difficult as it is to learn those actual verses of the Torah to try to make that entire calculation. I mean, this must have just been boring as sin. It's just a brutal, brutal experience.
And they couldn't play cards.
I would assume not.
They say there were no cards on Noah's Ark because Noah was always standing on the deck.
Do they now?
Sorry.
That's not a problem. We can edit that out, I'm sure.
I don't know. Sorry. But when the flood, I can't believe I got you on that. Anyway, when the flood ends, Noah sends out the raven, and then he sends out the dove. Is there like, maybe it's like me bringing my own recollection, or I remember I had like a storybook about this when I was a kid, but I feel like, did the raven get a bad rap for not doing what the dove does, like finding this olive branch? Because it's, like, is there like a line of thinking that the raven is not good and the dove is good in tradition and rabbinic literature?
The answer is absolutely yes. I mean, the dove is always viewed as being a very, very positive and an animal or bird that's very much aligned with the Jewish people. We actually have an entire song that we sing on Shabbos at the Shabbos table that's basically dedicated to this episode as being an analogy for the Jewish people coming to rest on Shabbos, right? That the Yonah finds rest after 7 days, and we sing about that. Yonah matzah voma noach, that the dove actually finds rest after 7 days, and we look at that seventh day as being the seventh day of the week, as being Shabbos. The dove is white and expresses the purity of the Jewish people and all of that.
So, but it seems a little unfair to the raven.
I'm
so
sorry that you feel that way.
Well, just in the sense that, like, it's interesting to me that the raven goes out and can't find any dry land and circles the ark, and then 7 days later he's fired from this position and the dove gets the chance to go. Like, the raven might have been able to do it 7 days later when there's an olive branch there. It just, it's like the...
It's a valid question. What the rabbis picked up on is the actual expression that's used in the Torah, which is, I believe, something to the degree of Yatzov HaShov, Haloch Yatzov HaShov, that he sort of just went back and forth. Meaning he was wandering aimlessly.
Yatzov HaShov, that's
what as opposed to the Yonah seemingly being more purposeful and the dove actually trying to go out and fulfill his mission, looking around, flying around, seeing what there was to perhaps inhabit, as opposed to just, you know what, it's never going to happen, forget it, so why bother and why even try? And the raven is just found there circling around. And, you know, we sort of think about the Jewish people in that capacity, that even when things seem absolutely impossible and against all odds, and the chips are totally stacked against us, that nevertheless we push and we persevere, and more often than not, with God's help, we actually achieve.
And there's a particularly strange medrash on that Rashi quotes, that the
really strange medrash,
that the raven was reluctant to go out because it thought it was nervous to leave its mate, its wife, alone with Noah. It was afraid that this was all a ploy to
move in on his territory.
There must be a deeper level to that. I don't know if there's anything to.
Oh, there's a deeper level to everything.
I don't know. It's really
I can't even begin to weigh in on it exactly. I'm not sure. It is striking. It is strange, and I can only agree with you that, you know, so much of what goes on, and especially these first two parshiot, I think more than any, it's just. They're so obscure almost, and it just it demands explanation on the one hand, and on the other hand, it certainly seems that, you know, at every turn there's just so much really deep meaning that's lurking behind every verse and every word.
And speaking of symbolism, it's the idea of the dove with the olive branch is almost, I think, am I wrong? It's like that it's.
I think
maybe
it's universal.
Maybe, right. I was going to say, like, is it just because I'm Jewish that I think it? But it's like, it's in the UN and stuff, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I believe so.
That's, it's pretty, talk about the universal impact of the Bible. That's,
yeah, big time.
And it's such a, and it's, you know, you probably, if you ask somebody who didn't know, they'd be like, oh, you know, like, why is the dove with the olive branch peace? It doesn't even, like, it's very interesting that the specific context is peace between God and humans. And yet, it's adopted
on some level. Right.
It's adopted as an image for peace between humans and humans. It's just very.
The truth is, I was thinking about this a little bit today, actually, and I think it's actually a very. There's something very comforting about it because, you know, certainly we would all prefer peace before being brought to a point of war. Right? Wouldn't that be wonderful if we were all able to just have conversation and kind of hammer things out without there ever being a need for any peoples to actually. To actually go to war, on the one hand. On the other hand, war is I don't even want to say that it's a reality of life. It's a reality of history. Right? War has taken place and undoubtedly will continue to take place. But there's something comforting in that even after the fact, right? It's not just that a relationship is always salvageable and there's some message of hope that you don't have to be pushed or things don't have to escalate to a point of war, but that's even that after war actually takes place and it actually happens and there is not just a falling out but disaster and destruction, that there's still a manner of and a possibility of reconciliation even after the fact.
So the thing that you know got me thinking along the lines of like this is a story less about humans and more about God, almost learning a lesson, so to speak, and obviously, you know, God's not learning lessons, but the story begins with God kind of observing that people are terrible, right? He says, like, let's see, I don't know if I can find the verse, but, I got it right there. Bereishit Parakeh, that's the fifth chapter, the fifth verse, Pasuk He, where he says, you know, God sees, this is what it says, this is, I'm using the Koran translation. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that all the impulse of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So he sees that people are pretty bad. And the Lord repented that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. So God feels pretty regretful that he made these human beings, and that's when he decides that he's going to destroy the earth. The narrative of the ark, at least, it ends, they get off the ark, and...
Same realization.
And right, you know, Noah offers these sacrifices. He's taken some extra animals along to offer up as sacrificial offerings to God, and as soon as that happens, God says, let's see if I can find it here also, but he basically says the exact same thing. He goes, oh, now I've resolved myself that I'm not going to destroy humans anymore because I
realize... Lev Adam Ra Min Ura.
Right, oh, here it is.
He realizes that the inclination of the heart of man is evil from his very youth.
Right, three chapters later. The Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the impulse of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore everything living as I have done. So, it's... What changed? Like, in the beginning, people are terrible, so I need to destroy them, and now I've, you know, wreaked havoc on the earth. Everything living has been wiped out except for the inhabitants of this ark. And now I realize that they're pretty terrible, but I'm going to learn to live with it. It's like, what... Like, I mean, it seems to me like the... Whatever we're supposed to learn from this, it's got to hinge on that sort of those bookends to this narrative, and I mean I've got a theory, but I want to put it to you. What's your takeaway?
I want to hear your theory.
I mean, well, you know, so the ongoing struggle in the podcast, and I guess we'll learn if we start to get if we have listeners and we have listener feedback, we'll get a sense of, you know, what people know, when we're assuming people know too much, what's elementary, what's basic, what need, you know. But the thing to me is like, so you know, I guess apologies if this assumes too much, but it seems to me that like it gets to the question of, why did God create the world at all? I mean, I think that's a pretty legitimate and basic question for the book of Genesis and for theology in general. Why does God make us? Why, you know, how does God make us? If he's perfect and we're imperfect, how does he allow imperfection? But also, you know, but why does God create the world? And if God, so, you know, this can go in a million different philosophical directions, but I guess if you believe on a certain level that God has to create these, that God wants to see good created, sort of wants to see if there can be good outside of him, beyond him, I don't know, but he can't have angels. You know, he creates beings, us, who can choose, have free will. We can choose good or bad. Then, you know, the hope perhaps is that we're going to do good. But, you know, this Torah portion is showing, well, we don't always. And the downside is that people are going to choose to do the wrong thing again and again and again. And it's almost, and again, you know, how you talk about God changing and God learning, I guess there's a level of, whether it's, you know, again, we're using very figurative language, but surprise, or God having to, you know, recalibrate, seeing that humanity, that giving us the potential to choose the wrong thing is sort of part of the package. And while at first, it's like, you know, you choose the wrong thing, there's going to be consequences right away, sort of coming out of it and seeing that you know, whether it's because Noah survives, whether it's because Noah gives the sacrifices, however it goes, the point is that the lesson to be taken away from this story is that, you know, God recognizes that we might do the wrong thing, but then God also has faith in us, or accepts that we might be able to, that we still need to be here because we've got a mission to do, and we can't achieve that mission of perfecting the world, of doing good, of uplifting, transcending, redeeming, whatever it is, without allowing the potential that it might really, really go off the rails. And just to wrap it up, I think then that it becomes like that's why this is important in the context of getting us to Abraham, and ultimately to getting to the Torah, that like the creation, without getting too egotistical, but the creation of the Jewish people and the giving of a law book become these sort of like calculated interventions to kind of like bend the arc of humanity, or correct the crooked timber of humanity. It's a brace, so to speak, on the fact that we are so capable of choosing the wrong thing. I don't know how fully baked that sounds, but
no, I think that's all very fair. And I would perhaps just add that clearly that's where the story ends. The story ends with God being reconciled to the fact that, people are fundamentally, if left to their own devices, will not just automatically choose the right things, right? That the physical universe as it's been created is flawed. Human beings, as they are created, are fundamentally flawed. Finite existence is, by definition, imperfect. What exactly was this great turnaround then? Like, what did God achieve then by creating the flood? If he ends up in the exact same position at the end of it as that he was at the beginning of it, maybe he also speaks to the fact that having said all of that, and with the full brunt of that very humanistic lesson, you know, notwithstanding, that there's still accountability. Meaning, God can still ask or even demand that we be better than we would be if left to our own devices. But there's at the same time this that's measured by this recognition that it's going to be really, really hard for us. It's going to be really challenging for us, and it's never going to be quite as perfect as God or even we might hope.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of sets a challenge for us. We're definitely learning something reading this. We've got another symbol beyond the dove, and that's the rainbow. That God sort of says the rainbow is the sign that I'm not going to destroy the earth again. And do you get like sort of a warm and fuzzy feeling or shivers when you see a rainbow?
Yeah, a little of both, I guess. You know, it's beautiful. It's wonderful to see. It's an incredible natural phenomenon. I'm very taken with something that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about and spoke about in a number of different contexts with respect to the rainbow, which was actually almost using the rainbow as the line of demarcation between Noah and Abraham.
Okay.
Why it is that Abraham becomes the father of the Jewish people and Noah simply does it. We name our children Noah, at least every now and again. We're very fond of Noah and we look at him very, very favorably on the one hand. On the other hand, he's really not our patriarch. What's the difference? The difference is that Abraham was capable of realizing that from the darkest cloud can come the brightest light and effectively spent his entire life, career, if you will, trying to convince people of their own inner worth and value, even after this parsha ends with a realization that people will never be perfect. People are fundamentally flawed, but they are still so much more capable of achieving so much more than they're likely to give themselves credit for. And Abraham is trying to draw out that godly spark in every single individual. Abraham, the men, and Sarah, the women. That was how they built their, I don't know, for lack of a better term, their ministry, I guess. And Noah doesn't. And the silence is just deafening.
Well, that gets to the rabbinic ambivalence towards him, is that, you know, that he's not making the effort to
pray on their behalf. You know, Abraham's informed that Sodom and Gomorrah, which are replete with just the worst brand of people you can possibly imagine. And God says, you know what, enough is enough, I'm going to destroy them. And Abraham just tugs at God's coattails and grabs him by the lapels and just begs and pleads for mercy on their behalf. Just because they're people, just because they're human beings. These obviously at this point are not even like co-religionists or distant cousins that he feels sorry for. These are foreigners, they're just human beings. And when Noah is told that he has the opportunity to save himself and his family, he does. But we don't find there being a whole lot of interceding on behalf of the rest of society.
So I think we'll talk about that when we get to it. Because one thing that I think plays into what you were saying before about there being accountability is that Noah, like that's sort of brought up a lot in terms of Judaism's support for human rights, and we're defending people just because they're human. But it's interesting that the line of defense that Abraham chooses is like, not like, oh, they're humans. Aren't humans inherently valuable? To which God would be like, yes, I know I made them. I can choose to do what I want. But rather he says, well, aren't there righteous people who live there that might themselves save the place?
Yeah.
And I think what he stops when he gets to 10.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that if Noah and his family are righteous, there's eight of them. So I don't know how that plays in. But anyway, but I think, you know, the bulk of the story ends there. But there's this very disturbing postscript where, you know, it says the first thing that he plants when he goes back to when he gets off the ark is a vineyard. And he does this to get himself drunk. And that's, I think, there's another piece of the rabbinic critique of him in that, that he shouldn't have planted the vineyard first. But it's, I'm reading that, and it just seems to me like there's like a level of PTSD in there that, you know, talking about how challenging, it's very interesting that on one hand, this is the man who saves humanity, but the Torah acknowledges that that's a really heavy burden. Do you see it that way?
So, I definitely see this as a continuation of Noah's general approach to life, and maybe we'll, you know, spend a minute just comparing him again to Abraham in that regard. I think, to me, what's so interesting, we know that alcoholism is a big problem, right? Alcohol can serve as this, or substance abuse or any behavior in a similar fashion can serve as, on some level, this sort of safety blanket that when things are really rough, this is my escape. Noah doesn't just, you know, reach into the cupboard and pull out a bottle of Jim Beam. It's so premeditated, right? The Torah describes in detail about how he gets off the boat and he has seeds and he plants the seeds and then he cultivates his entire vineyard, all seemingly for the purpose of ultimately ending up drunk. And to me, what this is about much, much more so is that Noah views his entire world and this narrative and this relationship between himself as God as very much sitting in sort of a backseat, sort of letting God be completely in control. And God, whatever you want, whatever you decide, whatever you do, Noah doesn't barter and doesn't bargain. He doesn't pray and he doesn't plead and he doesn't beg. God tells him to build a boat. If you want me to build a boat, then I'll build a boat. Tell me who to bring on it. Tell me what to do. And I'll follow it all to a T. And when he comes off, he basically absolves himself of conscious and clear thinking. And he gets himself drunk. And he's just laying in a drunken stupor as if he has none of his own consciousness, as if he has none of his own intelligent thought, letting God just be completely in control. Of course, it doesn't work. What we're going to see in a number of generations from now in Abraham is the exact opposite. It's even true in terms of the relationship that God expresses between himself and Abraham, saying that Abraham walks before me, as opposed to God walking side by side with Noah, which is something that the rabbis pick up on. Noah almost needs support. He needs to be held up as though on like divine crutches. And Abraham is sort of able to just run and go and do on his own because he views himself as being a player. He views himself as being the one who's been given a mandate by God to go and change the world and change humanity and change the planet. And he's trying to do so, but he recognizes how important, how critical his own effort needs to be, as opposed to Noah, who just seems to be very happy to divest himself of all that responsibility and say, God, it's your planet. You run the show.
And I may have heard this somewhere somewhere in my education, but what is there an idea where he's almost trying to get back to the Garden of Eden?
We may have spoken about this at some point. I actually gave
learning with you that, it's interesting. It just struck, the idea of, I think there's like some idea that the fruit in the Garden of Eden,
yes,
was the grape, but more striking. So that I'd heard before, but I don't think I'd ever heard the idea that then he becomes naked. Like if the thing that happens to Adam and Eve is they realize they're naked, then he wants to go back to a reality where he is not cognizant of the fact that he's naked.
Not cognizant of the fact that he's naked. So he's both naked and also drunk, which means that perhaps he is divesting himself of his own dot, of his own knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And correct, the one other, you know, postscript to that is that although we know where the Torah describes that all kinds of beautiful trees and fruits were growing in the Garden of Eden, there isn't necessarily any indication, at least in the Torah itself, that the tree of knowledge was per se different from any of the other trees around it. Meaning even in English we refer to something as being forbidden fruit. It is enticing and appealing purely because it is forbidden, not because it's different in kind from anything else. Meaning to say that if it was indeed a grapevine, it may have been standing next to lots and lots of other grapevines that were less appealing simply because they were permitted as opposed to forbidden, which would also mean that smack dab in the center of the Garden of Eden wasn't so much a garden, but perhaps a vineyard, which is exactly what Noah replants as soon as he gets off the boat.
What does it say about? We spoke about his passivity, but is there a what does it mean for him to want to get back to the Garden of Eden? Is he like thinking, well, you know, I think rebirth, kind of thing.
I think rebirth, you know, God has given all of society and the entire world a second lease on life. And what's my role here? My role is to replant and reestablish the Garden of Eden. And how do I do that? I do that by removing myself from the picture and letting God be in control. And Abraham and Sarah take the exact opposite approach. How do we do it? We do it by taking control. We do it by taking control, by serving as ambassadors on God's behalf, representatives on his behalf, and trying to sort of spread the good word and draw his light and his knowledge and his beauty and his wisdom down into the rest of the planet.
And there's a debate, sort of his son Ham does something terrible to him. It's very
murky,
quiet, euphemistic about what it is. There's an idea that he's castrating him possibly, or he's doing something very, very debasing to his father, and then the other brothers cover him up, and then he goes and he curses Ham. Can we, and we may edit all of this out, but like, this has become, there's some, and I don't know where it appears, if it's in Medrash, how prominently, but there's definitely an idea, which is in Judaism, that Ham is the forefather to Ethiopia, to the Cushim, who are identified as the Ethiopians, and that's fed into a lot of racism, or some justification when there is racism in the Jewish community. I've heard it when I was younger, and is, you know, how do we acknowledge when we have a source like that in our tradition, which we don't want to disown anything which comes from the authentic rabbinic tradition, but on the other hand, it has a really problematic legacy that we, you know, recognize that it runs, it gives one idea, one source runs so counter to so many other ideas that we have about people being created in the image of God and people, and treating people fairly and treating people properly. And sort of how do you, as a rabbi, like how do you balance that or live with that?
So I think that the issue or the concern there comes not so much from the source itself, and to be frank, I'm not sure what the source is or if there necessarily is a source, although I think it may just be a matter of sort of piecing together a number of different issues. Ham is related to the word Chum, which is brown, which perhaps refers to a pigmentation of skin, and we do find that later on in the genealogy of Ham, that we do find Cush emerge. Cush is Ethiopia, so sort of a relation with relationship to to African tribes or African peoples. Even I don't know that there's anything, and maybe this will run afoul of an actual contemporary definition, but at least ethically or morally, I don't find there being anything especially compromising about that in of itself. I think the problem is when we take something like that and then give ourselves license to say, oh, well, what that means is that I can mistreat people on the backs of this. And that's never okay. That does run counter to what the Torah tells us about respecting one another and about the legacy of Abraham and Sarah and all of their progeny and the idea of being created B'Tselem Elokim in the image of God and trying to see that godliness in every human being. You know, if it were the case that Ham being one of eight people on the planet ends up being a minority, is that something that you could imagine would make him feel very much at odds with his brothers, wake up one morning and be completely different, not just from the majority of the rest of the human race as it exists at the time, but different externally from everybody else? Is that something that would be that could be construed as a curse? Sure, absolutely. That would be extremely uncomfortable. Does that mean today that we have license to run around to anybody who looks different or sounds different or speaks with an accent or has different shaped eyes or different colored skin and say, I know that I'm better than you and therefore I can speak down to you? I think that's totally contrary to what Judaism is. Maybe we have to be very, very careful about plucking or cherry picking, one line or two from a Medrash or a Gemara someplace that's taken out of context and then using it as sort of a license to act or behave in the sort of ways that really really just have no place within Judaism.
I think that you just did a very good job of walking the line between really reading into what the Medrash, which again, we, you know, have to maybe look at the source, maybe if we are, you know, giving show notes, what it would be, what, you know, where the source is, but assuming that's a, you know, that's a source of pulling apart what the legitimacy might be. And I think even the idea of what that curse might be, and then, you know, but completely separating that. So I'm not sure what my feelings are on it. I mean, I think one piece for me that you throw in there is the, is just that we think that, like, in most cases, when there's sort of a national stigma attached, like, as we're going to see, the Moabites, the Ammonites, we say that we don't know who those people are anymore. Amalek, for sure. This is a nation we have to destroy. And we say, well, you know, we don't know who they are anymore, so we're not really that genocidal, because, like, it's kind of taken off the table. I feel like that's a piece of it as well, that, like, even saying that, like, this issue of lineage is still the case, that I could, you know, connect to the, you know, what's in this parsha. To me, that's a piece of it as well. You don't have to elaborate, but to me, that like even maintaining the connection, I think, is something which I think is very, very in my mind feels tenuous and inappropriate.
One thing that I would just add, maybe, you know, more generally, is that just perhaps a cautionary note. I think this is something that we need to be very careful of in general. And maybe this is a well-placed comment, being that we're right on the verge. You know, the fault line that exists between these two parshiot of Noach and Lech Lecha, who are sort of pivoting from Noach and then about to be introduced to Abraham. We're about to go from, you know, what clearly, right, the first two parshiot of the Torah are obviously very universal in nature, because it's before the actual advent of the Jewish people and the Jewish nation, you know, in particular. And, you know, we're about to go all in on Judaism. We're about to go all in on the Jewish nation and the Jewish people. Not to say that there isn't a whole lot of you know, universalism and broad lessons of morality and ethics contained in the rest of the Torah, even so. But I think this is a place where we Jews need to be very, very careful and need to recognize that what it means to be a chosen nation is something that we need to be immensely proud of, to never shy away from. The moment we begin to say that or begin to define Judaism as basically, you know, a series of teachings that basically tell us to kind of be nice people, is the day that we effectively abandon Judaism altogether and abandon what it means to have a very special and very unique relationship with God, and a very special and unique role in history and in the universe, on the one hand. On the other hand, that's a responsibility that should never make us feel that we are fundamentally better in the way that we should be holding our noses up in the air and be snooty about it any more than you know, a teacher towards students, or maybe even parents towards children. We have a role, we have a job, we have a responsibility. It's our obligation to perform the mitzvah, to bring God's goodness down into the world so that everybody ultimately can benefit from it, not just ourselves. And if it's a responsibility that we take as such and we believe in as such, hopefully that stands to as something of a counterweight against any possibility of arrogance or snobbery.
So wrapping up the parsha and the podcast, the parsha ends with a much shorter but kind of a companion piece of the Tower of Babel. These people who are building this tower that they're trying to reach to God with, and then their languages get scrambled and they can't communicate. And ultimately, you know, God sort of laughs at them and spreads them out and disperses them. And where does that fit in?
Well, it's almost the opposite end of the spectrum, isn't it? Meaning the way that, at least that we, and there are certainly allusions to it in the Torah itself in terms of the language that's being used, but certainly the way that the rabbis interpret what the sins were in the time of Noah is that it wasn't just lawless, but it was an extraordinarily selfish society, Right. There was robbery. People were stealing from one another. There was immorality, running off with other people's wives and the like. And then what you have is that the pendulum almost swings too far in the opposite direction, in that you have this society that is all society, right? It's all about the collective and not enough about the individual, perhaps, right? That they're all bound together in lockstep for this extraordinary purpose of overthrowing God. It's sort of like you missed the point. Like, you were able to finally collaborate and get together and talk to one another, but not enough to actually figure out what your purpose was really supposed to be and what you were supposed to be doing with yourselves.
I once read that, you know, the social extremes, you know, go from either the, from the small mustache to the big mustache. I mean, you get like Hitler fascism where, you know, the strong against the weak, people take what they want and can, you know, destroy minorities, and versus, you know, Stalin's fat mustache where, you know, there's the collective identity, you know, godless communism, so to speak, where, you know, and if you don't fit into the collectivism, that ultimately becomes very oppressive.
So you can't see us, but right now we're both wearing curly mustaches.
And twirling them, too. Indeed. So any parting thoughts, any big takeaways before we sign off?
I think what I'm going to be spending the next week or so thinking about, still reflecting on Noach and sort of leading up to Abraham, is what exactly does it mean to be Jewish? And what exactly does this great pivot really mean and really look like? Noach was somebody who, on the one hand, we speak about and we think of as being very admirable, certainly considering the time in which he lived, and yet doesn't exactly hold a candle to, and doesn't exactly, you know, measure up to Abraham. And I think that's a question that we all have to ask ourselves. We who are children of Abraham and of Sarah and Lessa, although strictly speaking, we are likewise children of Noah, but, you know, spiritually, we don't really make that same sort of connection. So what exactly does it mean? What exactly does it mean to land in their lap as opposed to in Noah's? And what does that mean for us as people? What exactly is our mandate moving forward?
And if you happen to not be Jewish and listening to this podcast, you can think about that, too. I guess in closing, our first ever fully recorded episode, certainly becomes clear there's always going to be a lot more to learn. But hopefully you'll delve in and be with us next week for The Portion. The Portion is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey by Aaron Roller and Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld. Engineered by Aaron Roller. Have a good Shabbos.